Jay jumps a tiny bit as she hears the cell phones on two guys in chairs not 15 feet away begin to chirp with annoying, happy ringtones. Jay says quietly into her phone, "We have a winner. Two winners, actually. They're about 15 feet to my left." Todd says, "I see them." David says, "We see them, too." The two guys pull out their phones and answer them. Todd's programmed to receive a recorded sales pitch for a credit card. They immediately hang up and look at one another, shaking their heads in annoyance, as one mutters something to the other. Neither suspects they've been ID'd. David says, "Uh-oh, there's Pete just coming in. This is getting interesting." One of the guys from KC spots Pete and gestures to his accomplice, who nods. They sit quietly, watching Pete stride across the lobby to the elevators. They both get up and walk to the elevator and get in with Pete. A family with two small children gets in, as does a bellhop. Pete does not recognize the two guys from KC. David, Lance, and Jay watch as the elevator begins to ascend. David says to Jay on the phone, "We're out of here. We'll duck down the emergency staircase to the next floor and then circle back and take the elevator down the lobby. Can you try to patch the feed from Pete's room to my cell phone?" Jay says, "No problem. I'll have you on audio and video in about 15 seconds. Todd, you still there?" "Yep, just watching the lobby feed. Keep the channel open. I'm also monitoring Pete's room." Lance says, "Watch for Prince. I think there's going to be police here real soon," as he tosses him a small towel and begins wiping all the surfaces they may have touched. "What do you mean?" "Those are hitmen, dude. Pete's about to check out for good." "Yikes. Yikes indeed. Now fucking move it." David and Lance quickly dart out of the room and into the adjacent emergency staircase. They begin running down the stairs to the next floor where they re-enter the corridor and race to the elevator. Jay disables the security cams in their path as they proceed. "They got here pretty quick," says David. "Well, there are airplanes, you know. There's a commuter run between here and KC about five times a day. With the right incentive, you can have very prompt service, and I'm sure Jack paid for the best," says Lance. The elevator stops on several floors until just Pete and his two visitors from KC are left. On the top floor, Pete gets out. The two follow him. About halfway down the hall, he begins to be uneasy. He walks faster. They walk faster. He begins to run to get to the safety of his room. They run faster. They hit him from behind, smashing his face against the door just as he tries to swipe the key card through the lock. One of the two wrenches Pete's arm painfully behind his back. The other slaps a piece of masking tape over his face as he tries to yelp out a scream. One of them takes the key card, which is dropped to the floor, and opens the door. They shove Pete into the room. Once in the room, they quickly bind his arms behind him and shove him onto the couch. They wrap his ankles together with duct tape. Pete squirms but is trapped and helpless. As David and Lance get on the elevator, the streaming audio and video feed begins to appear on David's phone. They hear the click of Pete's door opening, and they hear on the speakerphone an unfamiliar voice saying, "Move it, we don't have all day." Then they hear the unintelligible, muffled sound of Pete's terrified voice. "Jack's not happy about last night. He doesn't think he likes seeing his people on TV or in the morning papers. Pete knows Jack's hired these guys to take him out. He knows why these guys are here. That's the way Jack works. No warning." "Oh yeah, but this time Jack wants lots of publicity," chides one of them. "He wants it known that he can take care of a fuck-up like you. We're here to make this as messy as possible." One of the hitmen holds a gun on Pete while the other quickly closes Pete's laptop, grabs Pete's loose papers, and stuffs them into the laptop bag. He carefully checks around the room for anything Jack might not want the police to see, then says, "Okay, I think we're ready." "We're not going to shoot you, dude. We're going to let you fly out of here on your own." At which one grabs Pete by the legs and the other grabs him by the shoulders. Pete kicks, squirms, and emits muffled screams as they quickly carry him over to the balcony, give a couple of practice swings, then hurl his writhing body over the balcony and out into the open atrium beyond. David and Lance exit the elevator and walk towards Jay. All three are looking up towards Pete's room. Jay has her camcorder. Suddenly they see Pete fly over the balcony, wriggling frantically, his arms and legs tied, his mouth gagged. Pete begins his parabolic final descent to the floor below, announced with only an inaudible, muffled scream. The two killers stand at the balcony for a brief moment and watch, grinning at their handiwork. No one in the lobby has heard Pete's soft last cry. Even if Pete were in full voice, the laughter and din of the lunch crowd below, accompanied by an overloud piano, would be enough to drown out an opera singer. Suddenly, a woman spots movement in the air high above and gives forth with a blood-curdling shriek. Others quickly look up. The screaming becomes general throughout the lobby. The piano player freezes in mid-stanza. The hitmen quickly decide it's time to beat their retreat, and they rush out of Pete's room and down the emergency staircase. A second later, the crescendo of screams halts abruptly in a crashing thud thud of impact that echoes through the massive open space. Pete's descent terminates among the luncheon buffet's crab dip platters, little cocktail forks thrust into the flesh of his unconscious corpse. Plates, silverware, serving trays, bowls, and utensils fly upward in all directions. There is, for a fraction of a second, absolute, stunned, dead silence, followed immediately by the thundering clatter and crash of all those items sent airborne, returning back to Earth. Another moment of silence, except for the sounds of round platters spiraling on the floor. Then bottles of wine and liquor that have fallen finish their roll across the tables and begin to crash on the brick floor beneath. The sound of shattering glass is followed by the first stunned but now hysterical screams from the formerly contented dining patrons, who watch as the spilled alcohol from the upset hot plate warmers blossoms into blue flame. The festival paper winter decorations, linens, and napkins join the fire. Pete's Wagnerian crab-dipped immolation rises to an aromatic apotheosis as bottles of very high-proof cognac, used to flambé the occasional entree or dessert, topple and burst into vigorous and colorful incandescence. As Pete incinerates, the dessert liquors festively join the growing inferno. The pyre is finally brought to completion by a small propane cylinder hidden beneath the tables used to provide gas for the rotisserie. Its control valve is ruptured from the force of the impact that collapsed the center of the table. The ruptured tank gushes forth a cloud of flammable gas, which promptly explodes. The resulting fireball swiftly surges up through all 9 stories of the open atrium until it liberates itself in the cold Nebraska air through the shattered skylights of the ceiling high above. A storm of glass shards, hors d'oeuvres, and little bits of peat fall at various speeds to the lobby far below, while people quickly duck under tables for cover. David, Lance, and Jay stagger and look at one another grinning and say in unison, "Holy shit!" with enthusiasm. David says, "I think it's time we checked out, too." Lance says, "Right, dude. Let's go before something else happens." They quickly pull on their coats and gloves and wrap themselves in scarves and join the throng pushing for the exits to leave the scene of chaos and fire behind. When the guys from KC reach the parking lot behind the building, they calmly walk to the main street a block away and hail a cab back to the airport. However, once in the cab, Todd can't resist. He rings both their phones. When they answer in unison, he says, "Nice work, guys. Got it all on video. Nice arc on the Pete toss. So, we're awarding you both of Pete's ears. Unfortunately, you blew his fucking tail off. Now, where in Kansas City would you like the body parts delivered?" They flip their phones shut, look in horror at one another, and cringe in panic at their discovery. Jay is first to the SUV, and she leaps in the driver's seat, and off they ride. Jay executes a high G U-turn and swiftly heads towards the club, just as the first fire engine screamed to the scene. She parks the SUV in the lot behind. They all go in and straight to David's apartment. David, Jay, and Lance collapse on the couches, and Todd says, "Wow, didn't see that coming." "No shit," says Lance. "Those guys were pro. In, out, quick, and splashy." Mike chimes in and says, "So, tell us what happened up on the balcony. We couldn't see that part from the laptop cam after they closed it. We saw Pete's body hit the buffet, then it looked like a bomb went off. Napara must have gone off because we lost the signal. The local TV news cut in a few minutes ago saying there'd been an explosion at the Regency Hotel." David and Lance fill Mike and Todd in on the details while Jay gets some beers and cold pizza from the kitchen. "Oh, by the way, do you know that one of Todd's root kits has already managed to install itself on Jack's machine in St. Louis?" says Jay. "Oh, really? That's great," says David. "Yeah, and it's already started propagating itself across the machines in his email address book. Anyway, I started attaching copies of the viruses onto all the email that Pete was sending to St. Louis. I sent them using various buffer overflow and Trojan exploits. I guess one of them finally succeeded and infected Jack's laptop. I've established contact with it, and from the messages I'm getting back, everything is okay. The root kit is installed and functioning perfectly. Once it got on his machine, it started hitting other machines in his network, since they were all vulnerable to the same exploit. After infecting Jack's machine, it was easy to do the rest of the network. I should have gotten updated copies of Jack's address books by now. Let me check. Yep, there they are. I'm getting copies of his email files. I'll start sending out messages to the other machines on his network that I've compromised and see how many I control. Then I'll see if there are any new nodes and try to capture those. Soon I'll have copies of all the files on his machine and see everything he does in real time," says Todd, pulling out a keyboard and logging into a server. "Got any video?" asks David. "Well, let's see if his machine has a webcam." "Yep, it does. I'll switch it on in a low-res reduced frame mode." "Geez, this is amazing," says Mike. While Todd initiates the webcam feed from St. Louis, David punches up the cable news networks and local stations in multiple separate windows. "Here it comes," he says gleefully. Within minutes, there are news alerts and special bulletins galore as talking head news readers fumble with papers trying to make out what's being said in their IFBs. Jay's tape rolls on each. The Omaha stations cut in with the video as well. They see again the lurid detail of Pete's descent, the resulting explosion and fireball. The networks, never missing an opportunity to beat a story to death, replay it over and over again, both in regular and slow motion. Shocked, coiffed talking heads with no knowledge of the event expound endlessly nonetheless. Finally, after multiple replays, each goes to a discussion relating the event they just witnessed to the events in Omaha earlier in the week. The video, however, continues to cycle in an insert box. Questions are asked and speculation is rampant. They replay the video from the club, the video from the rest stop, and then more replays of the hotel event.